friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USAIrishRadio.com, worldwide. I'm very pleased indeed to welcome a friend for too many decades to go back. The retired president of Quinnipiac University, and of course the retired chairman of the board of the New York City St. Patrick's Day Parade, I want to welcome Dr. John Leahy. Hello there, John.
Hi, Adrian. It's great to be with you. And just to remind you, the first time you had me on your show was on St. Patrick's Day in 1997 when I was the Grand Marshal. So I remember it like it was yesterday. It was an enjoyable time that I spent with you.
Well, John, even at that point, you had taken a position on, the theme of St. Patrick's Day, the year that you were Grand Marshal, in dedicating and, revealing, some facts that we were now privy to, particularly those growing up in Ireland and rural Ireland, the topic of the Great Hunger, commonly known as the Great Irish Famine. At that point, you shocked most of us because it was the first time that we were hearing, out loud at least anyway, that it wasn't a famine as such, but it was a great hunger, and in fact, that the British, I don't know if you mentioned genocide, but I know we've since that day we've been referring to it as something which could have been avoided. And maybe if you just bring us back to that day and that year.
Sure, Adrian. I was fortunate enough, in 1997, I had just read within the previous year a new book that had come out by Christine Keneally, the foremost authority on the Great Hunger, and it's called This Great Calamity. So I had just finished reading the book, and in a way, it was my own awakening. You know, I grew up in the Bronx and Riverdale section of the Bronx, a very Irish parish, St. Margaret's Parish, and as a kid, we didn't hear very much about it. We knew the famine was some dark thing that happened, and it was the reason why my father's father, as a kid, left Ireland and ultimately came to New York, and so we knew it related to the great growth of Irish America, and particularly in our part of the world, in New York City. But it really wasn't discussed. It was kind of a taboo topic, and so when I read Christine's book, really for the first time, I became aware to the extent that you mentioned that this was really not a famine in the sense that there was plenty of food. The potato crop failed for 5 years, that the Irish, and particularly in the west of Ireland and southwest, were very dependent on. But there was plenty of food produced in Ireland during that period that was unfortunately under British control and shipped out of Ireland all during those terrible 5 years, 1845 to 1852. So and I guess the educator in me, after I was selected to be the Grand Marshal, I think I was one of the first Grand Marshals that were not, I was born in Ireland. And most of them talked about, their parents and their grandparents and life in Ireland, and I didn't have that to talk about. So I guess the combination of that and the educator in me, I thought I would use the platform that the Grand Marshalship gives you to educate people about the Great Hunger. And, of course, Ireland at that year, 1997, it was the 150th anniversary of the famine, of the Great Hunger. They used the date 1847, Black 47, which was actually the third year of the Great Hunger, but it was the third consecutive year of a crop failure, and it was a very cold winter, and it was in the largest number of deaths actually occurred then. So the Irish government actually gave me the idea also, because they were commemorating the 150th anniversary, and they had commissioned some artwork by Rowan Gillespie in Dublin at the Custom House Quay, the famine figures there, and John Behan's famous famine ship in your part of the world, in Croagh-Patrick in County Mayo. And so the Irish government was, for the first time really, actually the 100th anniversary, they did very little commemoration. But by 97, the Irish Celtic Tiger was alive and doing well, and I think in many ways the Irish government and the Irish people could look at the famine and the great hunger and talk about it in ways that maybe they found more difficult in earlier years. So all that gave me the idea to use the great hunger as the theme of the parade, and the parade officials were good enough to dedicate the parade to the great hunger. We actually stopped the parade for the first time in history for a moment of silence at noon that day. The parade starts at 11:30, and we stopped the entire parade for a moment of silence in memory of the a million and a half who died during the great hunger, and the 2 million plus who had to leave Ireland to avoid starvation and death. As I tell people who become Grand Marshals subsequent, the easy part about being Grand Marshal is leading the parade up Fifth Avenue that day. The more challenging part is from January 1 to March 17th, every Irish organization in New York has their annual fundraiser and get-together, the Emerald Societies and the AOHs, and, of course, they want the Grand Marshal there to say a few words. And so you get literally 100 invitations to speak, and I probably went to 40 or 50 of them. And I used the opportunity at those events to say how honored and privileged I felt to be an Irish American, and to no greater honor you can receive than to be the Grand Marshal of the New York City St. Patrick's Day Parade. But I used that opportunity to educate more people about the true facts of the famine. And as you said, it was a potato crop failure, but there was plenty of food. So it was really a political decision made by the ruling party, the British government, who was in charge in Ireland during that period, to not lower the tariffs, not provide relief of any significance. And what might have started as a natural disaster of a potato crop failure turned into one of the worst cases of bigotry and discrimination and death and starvation in 19th century Europe. And it turned into, as Christine said, this great calamity, the worst case of anti-Irish and anti-Catholic bigotry in history. I did try to, on the positive side of my remarks in those speeches that I gave, I did try to say there is the positive story is that because of the great hunger, we have in this country 35 million Irish Americans, and 25 million of them live in the Northeast, and of course New York and Boston, two of the largest Irish populations anywhere in the world. And so the Irish did come to this country. They started at the lowest rung and worked hard and with a strong commitment to family and faith, they helped build this country in places like New York and Boston into the great cities that they became. They built their Catholic Church into the huge, influential Catholic Church that it became, developed the parochial schools, one of the finest K-12 educational systems anywhere in the world. And then, of course, they went into politics and union leaders and ultimately presidents. So it does have a positive side, at least for America. Irish America built America into the great country it is, but it was sadly at Ireland's loss, who lost so many of their best, because for the better part of 150 years after the Great Hunger started, there weren't very many opportunities for the Irish in Ireland, and the very best left. And of course, it was a huge drain of brain and good people and resources for Ireland. So it had that positive effect. But there's no question the Great Hunger is the most tragic event in Ireland's history, and held them back in terms of their development for over 150 years. That they've only, you know, since the 1990s, really, have come out of it and come out of it. I'm proud to say, very strong and a great country that we can all admire today.
My guest, John Lee, former president of Quinnipiac University. John, how does an Irish American lad from Riverdale wind up in Quinnipiac? Had you heard of the area? Did you know, where it began and where it ended? And what's the most attractive job to come to Quinnipiac with 1,900 enrollees and then take on the task of growing that, to 10,500 by the time you retired?
No, you're right. I didn't know much about Quinnipiac, but, after I went on to finish school in St. Margaret's Parish and Fordham Prep, and then I went to the University of Dayton and the University of Miami and Columbia, and I ultimately got a PhD and two master's degrees. The second job, I have one, my earliest teaching position was actually in a small Catholic college in Alabama, St. Bernard's College. But then I was able to get a position at Marist College in Poughkeepsie, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was at Marist from 1977 to 1987. And I started there running a number of programs and ultimately became vice president for development and then executive vice president by 1987. And I was 39 years old. I had 12 years experience under my belt. And in fact, I got Marist College into the St. Patrick's Day Parade. I was involved with the parade during the years I was at Marist already. So I didn't know anything about Quinnipiac at that point, but I was involved with the parade and the formation committee during those years. And then, the most attractive thing about Quinnipiac in 1987, when the presidency was open, was that it was a presidency. I remind some vice presidents from time to time. I know the difference between being a vice president and a president. And I would say a president is the more attractive position. But it was my first presidency. So I was in Poughkeepsie. I had heard of Quinnipiac. I really didn't know much about it. But you're quite right. I started there in March of 1987. It was just 1,902 students. As you said, when I left on June 30th, 2018, when I retired after 31 years as president, it had 10,500 students. When I went there in 87, we had three schools. By the time I left, we had nine schools, including a medical school, a law school, engineering schools, all of which I added. I did two things, though, in 1988, in my first full year. I started in the spring, actually, of 87. But that first full year, in the 87-88 year, I did two things that were important. And I knew Quinnipiac, to be successful, had to expand. And back then, it was just 1,900 students. Three-quarters of them came from Connecticut. It was basically a small commuter school. And I knew we had to expand and grow. And to do that, we had to get Quinnipiac better known outside of Connecticut. While people in Connecticut could pronounce Quinnipiac, outside of Connecticut, it was nearly impossible to either spell correctly or pronounce correctly. So I knew I had my work cut out for me. But I did two things in 1988. One was that I got Quinnipiac to admit it into the New York City St. Patrick's Day Parade. So we started marching in the in that first parade in March of 1988 and continued marching all the way until I retired in 2018, 30 years. And the second thing I did in 1988, I started the Quinnipiac Pole. And while I started it in Connecticut in 88, my plan all along was to move it into New York and then do New Jersey and do statewide poles. While it wasn't just this New York City St. Patrick's Day Parade that was an Irish event, there were many other things that I knew we needed to do to strengthen relationship with the Irish America. As I said, there are 35 million Irish Americans. One in 10 American is Irish heritage. And 25 million of the 35 million were in the Northeast. So they liked to go to private schools and private education, and education was very important to the Irish in terms of getting ahead. And so I developed, in addition to being in the parade, we also started teaching some Irish studies programs. We developed and expanded our study abroad program to the point that we send over 100 students every spring to National University of Ireland in Cork City. It's the most popular destination for our students. And then in 1997, as we were talking about the Great Hunger, After I finished my year of trying to educate more people about the Great Hunger, Murray Lender, on our Board of Trustees, the Vice Chairman of our board, was so taken with the story of the Great Hunger and the fact that he grew up in New Haven, which had a very large Irish population, also a significant Italian and a Jewish population. And he had many, many Irish friends, he said, and he'd never heard a thing about Great Hunger, and I explained to him that, you know, we didn't even talk about it a lot in the Irish neighborhood. I grew up in the Bronx, but he was just taken with the story, and I think he sort of saw parallels in terms of the Holocaust and what his parents, who actually were in Poland and with the rise of Hitler and were lucky enough to leave and to come to this country with very little and start a new life here. And in any event, Murray convinced me, he said, look, John, we want to keep this story going. So he and his brother made some gifts to Quinnipiac so that we could develop a specialty in the Great Hunger, develop library resources, artwork. In that, by the year 2000, we were expanding our library, and we incorporated into the library the Lender family special collection room, dedicated to on Gautamore, to the Great Hunger. And thanks to Murray's generosity and his brother Marvin's, we were able to get some artwork and educational materials. And so that's what started the Great Hunger. It was really my being in the parade, talking about the Great Hunger, and having one of our trustees and benefactors just be taken with the story and believing that it was a story that needed to be told, and Quinnipiac was an ideal place to do it. But with all those developments to the, in terms of Irish connections, it was, I think many people know about the Quinnipiac Pole. Maybe they don't know that I really, took advantage and started the pole so that we would get better known and we could expand and grow, in both in reputation and enrollment and resources. But I also used the Irish connections, the parade, the Great Hunger Museum, the Lender family, special collection room, the study abroad. We hired Christine Keneally, attracted her during that same period away from Drew University to come to Quinnipiac, and she started the academic side of the Ireland's Great Hunger Institute. So the museum and these Irish connections and the Quinnipiac Pole and you know, obviously adding a medical school and an engineering school. We moved to Division I hockey, and we have played for a national championship in hockey twice. So all of those things were critical pieces of really transforming Quinnipiac from a small local little college in 1987, as we said, of 1,900 students, into, by the time I retired in June 2018, it was literally transformed into a major nationally recognized university, and nationally recognized for a variety of things, for our medical school and law school, for the Quinnipiac Poll, for athletic program, and for our commitment to educating people about the Great Hunger, and all the various Irish and Irish American connections that we had. And I can tell you, Adrian, when I left, there were 50,000 alumni, living alumni. I had signed 40,000 of their diplomas, and I shook 40,000 hands. Every hand that graduated during those 30 years, I stood up there and handed a degree and shook their hand. And I literally signed with the same pen. I used a lot of refills in an ink pen that I used, but I signed every one of those diplomas and heard every one of their names announced at commencement. And I can tell you the number of Irish surnames was significant in the Quinnipiac population by the time we grew it from 1900 to 10,500. And of course, now they're part of the alumni group that make up such a significant part of the alumni group. So all these things helped really to transform a small little college into a major national university that obviously I'm very proud of.
As well you should be. Now, I'd like to take us to Ireland's Great Hunger Museum at Quinnipiac University. The word had actually reached Ireland, and it was, again, all the, your discussion there on all the various aspects was nearly as well known in Ireland as it was here in the United States, drew the attention, as we may know, of along the way, of prime ministers, one in particular, Taoiseach Enda Kenny, who was very supportive, and indeed, if you recall, we made a trip over there, and the first stop was to the Prime Minister, who was very welcoming, and indeed, to this day, he, among other things, he has... I'm not sure if he set up an office in his house back in Castlebar, but his honorary doctorate from Quinnipiac University, you'd think it was the only one he got in his life, he treasures very much. But he was so, I thought we might have to, educate him on Quinnipiac and what it was doing, and he knew every bit of it, and he became, Pied Piper in Ireland in rallying support and spreading the word.
No, you're absolutely right, and I again want to thank you for setting up that early meeting with the Taoiseach and the Kenny, and I also was able to meet him a number of times because he came and marched in the New York City St. Patrick's Day Parade, and did interviews with NBC. But you're absolutely right, Adrian. Enda Kenny was a huge supporter of what we were doing at Quinnipiac, and also, I might add, he was supportive of what I was trying to do with the parade and ultimately getting Irish America to catch up with Ireland in terms of their openness to gay and lesbians and and the efforts I was trying to change the parade and to integrate it with gay and lesbian marching groups, which we ultimately did. So, and it couldn't have been more supportive of what we did. He was also enormously influential in the collection ultimately going to Ireland. That plan was really hatched with him and with his support, and his support not only from his office, but financial support from the Foreign Affairs Department. And then he visited the museum in 2015. I had the honor of giving him a tour of the museum, and it was at that same day that he gave a major address to our faculty and students about Ireland and Irish America and about the Great Hunger. And of course, at that event, we gave him the an honorary doctorate. So you're absolutely right. I would say I certainly know Enda Kenny, the best of the prime ministers who have been there, during my tenure at Quinnipiac, and he couldn't have been more supportive of our efforts at Quinnipiac. And as I mentioned earlier, he was also a very supportive and helpful mm-hmm. in terms of moving the St. Patrick's Day Parade in the right direction. I also mentioned Leo Varadkar. This is while Enda Kenny was the Taoiseach. The museum was dedicated in 2012, and Leo Varadkar was the Minister of Tourism and Culture who was sent over to represent the Irish government. And he spoke, actually, at the dedication and was also aware of what we were trying to do with the St. Patrick's Day Parade. And then, of course, Leo succeeded Enda Kenny as the Taoiseach. So both of them have been very, very supportive of our efforts. And then I might add President Michael D. Higgins, also enormously supportive of what we were doing. I actually met him in Boston at an event where he talked about the Great Hunger some years earlier, and I was introduced to him there for the first time. But he gave opening remarks which were just so powerful and eloquent at the opening of the collection in Ireland. You know, as you know, we brought the collection there in March of 2018, and it spent about 3 months in Dublin Castle where we had the opening event, and Michael D. Higgins spoke there. And then we spent 3 more months at the West Cork Art Center with the collection, and then finally we had another 3 or 4 months in Derry City in Northern Ireland. So, yeah, there's no question that Enda in particular was just enormously supportive. And the last time I was with him, I think he just about to step down or was close, but I was over in Ireland and he invited me to lunch at the Marion Hotel, the underground restaurant that they have there, the lower part of the, mm-hmm. I forget the restaurant's name, but, and he was just stepping down and in the process of, stepping down and, but he was gracious enough to literally wouldn't even let me pay for lunch, but he wanted to just express his appreciation to all that, that I had been doing for the Great Hunger and connections between Quinnipiac and Ireland and Irish America and Ireland, in particular in connection with my parade activities.
You know, obviously, we've come a long way from, all the support and recognition of that undertaking and, you know, which led eventually to the establishment of the museum, Ireland's Great Hunger Museum, at Quinnipiac University. I want to fast forward a little bit to what many of us, and we're not going to get into any depth, but a lot of people have been severely disappointed and in shock that above all, a university, any university might, if they inherited and if they had a reputation for shining a light on a you know, on ethnic groups, their contribution to the United States, and more so educating people as to aspects of our history, which frankly most of us, including myself and you know, coming from a section of Ireland where my own parish had was the first to complain to the ground to the crown that we had the first death from starvation, and in that hunger, in that famine period. I still think that a lot of people can't believe that the museum was closed and permanently closed, and may have been under the impression, I'm sure some people still are, well, you know, we have had COVID, we've had tremendous restrictions all over the world with respect to museums and you know, all public events that came to a standstill. However, nobody even thought for a minute that you know, the lock on the door would, you know, remain there. And excuse me. And the announcement that, no, that's it. It's all over with. It's closed. What was your level of disappointment, and could you have seen that coming?
Well, I'm saddened and extremely disappointed, and frankly perplexed that, first of all, that anyone in this day and age would think it's a good idea to close down a museum dedicated to educating people about the evils of discrimination and bigotry, let alone one that tells the story of you know, an enormously large part of American society, and a story that has parallels in so many other groups that have been discriminated on the basis of their ethnicity or race or religion. So it's to me, it's I don't understand it. I'm very sad. And obviously, I was not involved with the decision, and I retired on June 30th, 2018. No one consulted me on this, and I did see it coming, I must say, in the sense that soon after I retired, you know, a new president's come in, so I'm not going to criticize. I had my 31 years and did what I thought was best for Quinnipiac and the community and so on. But, I mean, even within months of my retirement, the Quinnipiac University decided to pull out of marching in the St. Patrick's Day Parade, which we had been marching in for, as I said, I got them into the parade in 1988. And so this is way before COVID, yeah. And didn't cost, you know, there was some suggestion it was cost, you know, it cost $100 to affiliate with the St. Patrick's Day Parade and march in it. And so I sort of got a sense that maybe other things might happen. But I too was shocked when it was announced. In August, I did get an early signal because I was in touch with the executive director, Ryan Mahoney, who was let go in June. So I found that to be something that I was concerned about, that more might be just the first shoe to drop, and it turns out it was. And the other thing that's perplexing to me, Adrian, is that, you know, the museum is not a large museum. We're not talking about the Metropolitan Museum of Art here. It's a 5,000-square-foot building that was the original public library in Hamden. And so we acquired it and renovated it and moved the art that we had been collecting from thanks to Murray Lender since 1998. Sure. It was just so much of the art, we couldn't fit it all in the Lender family special collection room. So that was the reason for finding a larger place that we could put more of the art in one place and people could see it and we could better educate people. And so we acquired this small, modest building on Whitney Avenue near campus. It's been a shoestring operation from the beginning. I think the total budget's about $350,000. And when I was there, we never made it have to do any fundraising as such. We really wanted it to be open to the community. We didn't charge mm-hmm. anyone to come, and we brought school children there and other groups that would travel there. But with the new administration, they decided it had to become, I guess, self-sufficient, which is certainly their prerogative. But what was troubling is they raised in 2019-20, they raised about $145,000 of their $350,000 budget. So about 40% of their budget they raised, but they still had, you know, a deficit of about $200,000. That year, I thought they did a pretty good job in fundraising because the museum was forced to close down when COVID came, you know, January 2020, and then the entire school and the museum closed in March of 2020. So they only had about a half a year, really, to raise funds. And I thought they did a pretty good job starting from nothing, no fundraising being required of them, to, you know, getting almost half of the revenues. And then last year, in my conversations with Ryan Mahoney, I was under the impression that he had raised even more funds, again, a year when the museum was totally shut down. So I thought the deficit was, you know, only about $100,000 or so. But for whatever reason, it was announced that, you know, it didn't become self-sufficient. Frankly, given that we had just gone through 2 years of a pandemic, that the museum was literally closed for a year and a half during that period, I mean, it wouldn't be the only organization that struggled with fundraising during the pandemic and the closures that we've been going through the last year, 2 years. So, you know, for $100,000 shortfall, you know, not to give the museum another couple of years in a post-pandemic environment to raise funds, it just seemed to me to be without easy explanation. I'm, you know, obviously more than saddened. You know, there's a group trying to get the university to change their position on that. They claim they want to give it away to someone else, which again is perplexing to me as to why you'd want to give a collection like this that is so part of Quinnipiac brand at this point and our mission. And as you related, the Irish community, both in Ireland and Irish America, mm-hmm. is not happy, to say the least, and scratching their head trying to come up with some explanation. It's given its importance to Quinnipiac, the relationship with Ireland, as I said, our students studying abroad there, given our academic specialty at the Great Hunger, thanks to Christine Keneally and the Irish Great Hunger Institute, given our Irish Studies program, our involvement with the New York City St. Patrick's Day Parade, and the result of that, the whole tri-state Irish-American community where we recruit students. I'm just puzzled by the whole thing and unfortunately without any answers. So I don't know whether to be optimistic or not, but the decision was announced and I gather it still stands. But I do note that there are Irish groups in New York and Connecticut who are trying to bring this tragedy to the attention of more people in the hopes that maybe it will influence the university to change its position.
My guest, John Leahy. John, I think what is perplexing and what is very hard to understand is that just about every excuse that can be ruled out, by the current administration, it requires a lot of backtracking. First of all, it was, it says, we'll find, museums to take the collection without acknowledging the value of the entire collection. And so that went from, we're going to sell it to them and get, quote, our money back for Quinnipiac University. That to crying poverty, and without explaining that, the bank account was fairly hefty when you left. And if we're talking about, a budget, of $450 million, even higher when you left. The excuse of, saving $300,000 a year with a budget like that, that doesn't carry any water, frankly, and I don't think even those who are not too are only learning, about the museum, wouldn't subscribe to that one, because then you'd have to explain why, the university couldn't come up with $100 to, continue to hold its rightful place in the St. Patrick's Day Parade. So that one is a bit, that's a lame excuse, but if it wasn't that, it would be a lot of other things.
Yeah, I think, I'm not privy to the finances since I left, but you're right. When I left, the operating budget was just over $500 million. And within that operating budget, there was about a $30 million surplus. In addition, when I arrived in 1987, we had all of $3 million in our endowment. And when I left on June 30th, 2018, we had $530 million endowment. So, and the other thing, I'm sure some colleges, suffered some financial setbacks and during COVID. And I can remember I lived through the 2008-09 Great Recession, the worst recession since the Great Depression, when our endowment back then went from $240 million to $170 million, in a couple of days. So, but, finances ebb and flow, and universities need to think long term. And to me, a couple hundred thousand dollars at best, a university of the size of Quinnipiac, and the importance of the Great Hunger Museum and its related ties that it gives the university to Ireland and Irish America, and even if you're thinking of it in terms of finances, I wouldn't think so much of the expense of a couple hundred thousand. I think of the revenue of how many Irish American parents who are well aware of Quinnipiac's support of many things Irish are sending their kids to Quinnipiac because they know that the Irish are welcome and supportive and that there's interest and that the study abroad opportunities in Ireland there are significant. So, a couple hundred thousand dollars for a school that charges $70,000 tuition, room, and board, you could make $200,000 up with three students out of, 10,500. So, but again, I'm not privy to what's going on there. As I said, no one consulted me. I don't get financial reports from them over the past 3 years. But certainly, when I left the institution, extremely strong financial position, both on an operating basis and on a long-term endowment basis.
There is a, a general impression, and indeed I subscribe to it, in the sense that, maybe the current administration, and indeed the board, the board of directors, maybe they didn't expect any pushback from the closure. It's not as if they needed the building desperately. But I think they thought and had no problem in telling us that very, very few people, come to the museum, and again adding insult to injury, that it wasn't well known. So what the hell, just close it down and maybe nobody will notice. That's backfired. That has backfired big time. And in the lashing rain last Saturday at, the salute to the museum, we were careful not to use the word protest because, as Irish, we don't have much success in that area, but we don't mind saluting. Hundreds of people braved the weather to come out and, and to participate and to show their shock. And had we not created somewhat of a rumpus, chances are they would never know. The tide is turning, and I think, particularly in Ireland, it's Arlene McConnell who heads the Save the Museum campaign. It's gathering steam. It's gathering steam, and maybe there will be a change of heart there. It's rotten, publicity for the administration, and there's nobody to blame but themselves. But I know that in Ireland, people are just learning and wondering, if in fact that couldn't be true. Is this fake news or whatever? Well, it's not fake news, and I know that I plan to visit, the powers that be there. I'm sure that, President Michael G. Higgins and the successors to Enda Kenny, the former vice president, and Leo Varadkar, I wouldn't say they're going to take too kindly to the notion, but it's also, it totally disregards the 31 plus years and the accomplishments that you had, to kind of brush it all aside and say, it's not a big deal.
Yeah, and you mentioned I was not at the event last week that you referenced, the salute to the museum. But I was pleased that Senator Blumenthal was there and spoke very strongly. He sent me a video of his comments. And Richard Blumenthal was also at the he spoke at the dedication in 2012.
Yes.
Leo Varadkar. He also, he's been a dear friend and a great supporter of Quinnipiac for many, many years. He actually spoke also at an earlier dedication, almost 20 years earlier, pretty early in my tenure. We renovated another house, a building, and solicited a gift from Peter Harold, who was a client of a trustee, Don Proroth, was on our board. We had a gift for and it's the Peter Harold House for Jewish Life. And we renovated that facility. It's a beautiful facility for our Jewish students. And Dick Blumenthal, he was the Attorney General at the time.
All right.
And And he's come to many of our law school events, and we've honored him as well. So I was very pleased that he came and he spoke and he commented how important, as he said, great American universities don't close down museums, particularly those dedicated to Irish history, which, as he said, is really a big, big part of American history. And so we can only hope, Adrian.
I know.
But you're right. In the short run, it's unfortunate that damage is being done to a relationship that is strategic and, in my view, extremely important to Quinnipiac and our success as a university and our success in transforming ourselves from a small little college in Connecticut to a major university that's known nationally and indeed internationally,
yeah,
particularly in Ireland. It's unfortunate that whatever the outcome, which I hope will be that the decision gets reversed and the museum stays at Quinnipiac, but even if that occurs at this point, you know, I think unfortunately we're doing damage to a relationship that that Quinnipiac, and not just I, but I certainly had a lot to do with cultivating for not simply because I'm Irish and an Irish American, but it was an important relationship to cultivate for Quinnipiac University, for our student body, our alumni, and the larger community where we live and function.
You know, in the comedy of errors, you know, to have you know, the announcement now that you know, just about anybody who'll find, you know, a spot for this collection is welcome to it, including, mind you, their opposition. You know, it's no secret that, you know, Fairfield University, I mean, they're reaching out at such pace. I'm wondering, it brings me back to the opening line from Senator Blumenthal. He said, "I wish I was still the Attorney General." So feathers are ruffled, but a lot of silly decisions are being made. And in hindsight, maybe it was easier than to come out and from the very beginning and say, "Listen, that was John Leahy's gig. Now let's move on." Stupid and very offensive to a lot of people, and as more people find out about it, I think it's going to be a blemish on a terrific university.
Yeah, well, I hope that's, again, not the long-term effect and something can be corrected, but there's no question, I can't deny that in the short run, it's happening. No one knows the Irish American community, and particularly in our region in the Northeast, than you, Adrian. So, and you also know how strong our relationship was with, and hopefully still is to some degree, with Ireland and the Irish officials with whom you'll be meeting shortly. But I hope you extend my best wishes and appreciation to, as you meet with and to Kenny and the Override Car and President Higgins, for how much their support meant to me and to Quinnipiac for 31 years here. And I'm sad and frankly embarrassed about what's happening now, but it doesn't diminish my respect and appreciation and affection for the three of them and others, Niall Burgess and others in the Irish government, who have just, been enormously helpful to Quinnipiac. And why I hope they know my involvement with the Great Hunger is has certainly something to do with my being a proud Irish American, and my grandfather, Daniel Leahy from Knock Glossmore in Kerry, in County Kerry. I also did this in the best interest of Quinnipiac University, and so it didn't I hope I did something for Irish America and for Ireland in this effort, but Quinnipiac benefited enormously from our relationships in Ireland and with Irish America, and it just saddens me that that's getting damaged to any degree.
We will, you know, it's not over till it's over. I can say at this stage of the game, it looks like it's only starting, you know, from our lips to God's ears. And it will be a great occasion if, in fact, and, you know, it will, you know, it doesn't take us that long to forgive, you know, those poor decisions. But by the same token, we're equally good at holding a grudge. So listen, let me tell you.
Yeah. Famous for holding a grudge. We are. I plead guilty.
I was actually speaking. Oh, you're part of this. Oh, my God. There you are. John Lee, good luck. Best wishes to you and, of course, to Judy. And,
and enjoy,
you know,
your trip to Ireland. And,
thank you.
And congratulations again. It's the most, most well-deserved Presidential Distinguished Service Award that they've ever given. So.
Well, I thank you. Thank you for that. I'm still not moving my honorary doctorate from, you know, from the place, you know, because of if I move it, the
keep that eye on the wall as well. And we're honored to have you be an honorary Quinnipiac graduate.
Thank you. Thank you very much, John Leahy.
Great talking to you.
Thanks for listening to Irish Radio Network, USAIrishRadio.com. Wow. Thanks, John. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks, Adrian.
Great.
Best on you.
Wonderful. Thanks.